Hello, welcome back to the Matt Pfeiffer Experience. I am your host, Matthew Pfeiffer, and today I have on a very special guest. I have Scott Levin, the Chief Peacekeeper. He is a mediator out of San Diego, California, and I'm looking forward to having this conversation with you. Very common for people to, in some states, it's actually not only recommended, but it's mandatory for you to go through mediation before you actually go through the divorce process. And so I think it's important for you to understand strategy going in, strategy while you're going through that process, regardless if you're going through a divorce or if you're going through a modification. Maybe mediation is in your best interest and in your best solution, given your circumstances. So look forward to having this conversation with you. And with all that being said, let me introduce you to our guest. Scott, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for hopping on. And so I'm going to kick it over to you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and about your mediation practice.
Yeah, I'm a family law attorney and attorney going back to 2004, living in California. I went to law school. I went to undergraduate NYU in New York City. I went to law school at University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. Came back to California in 2004. Been practicing law ever since. I also have operated a number of businesses and startups. I'm kind of a finance person. So I'm also what's called a certified divorce financial analyst. I have a finance background that I bring to, the divorce world. They don't teach math in law school, I like to tell people. So, it's good to work with someone that understands, business and numbers. Since 2012, I stopped litigating in 2012. So I did that by choice to take a stand for society, to try to help my community get through the divorce process in a more healthy way. So I've been exclusively serving as a finance and attorney, but in the mediation setting for about 12 years.
I think it's always interesting when someone says the word divorce and healthy in the same sentence, because the perception is that you can't have a healthy divorce. And you and I were talking beforehand that oftentimes people automatically think that their situation is high conflict and they're dealing with narcissists, this and that. And I don't want to downplay, and I don't want to minimize people who might actually be dealing with violence or high conflict or anything like that, because those do exist. But for a lot of cases, it may feel like that because you're already not getting along. You already are at odds. And so naturally there's going to be some friction and there's going to be some conflict, by the time they get to you. And so I wanted to ask you, how often is it that when someone comes to you that they feel like this isn't something that could ever be mediated, but then they find out that, yeah, we actually have a lot more common ground than what we might actually think?
Yeah, I mean, it's common, I'll say, Matthew, every case is like a snowflake, they're all a little bit different. So, what I try to remind people about really is that, you have an option of mediation, you have an option of collaborative divorce, you have an option of litigation, do it yourself. Those are kind of the ways that you could go through this process. If you can't resolve it voluntarily, because that's really what mediation or an out-of-court settlement is, right? You hire someone to help you figure out what the solutions are to the divorce. You meet with, in my practice, we meet together, the three of us form a team, and we're on team us. And on the other side of the court are the issues of the process. Yeah. So the things we have to figure out are on that side. And so we attack those issues by creating solutions, going over ideas, collaborating, direct communication. We don't spend a lot of time, talking about how we got here or why. A lot of times I have no idea, why people are divorcing. I don't ask. But if you can't figure it out that way, I often tell people, that there's litigation and it's always going to be there for you. There's always going to be a lawyer that will take your money and help you get into the court system. But do you think that you're going to figure out, more of the solutions in that process than in mediation? I would argue that you won't. It will just take a lot longer. It will be a lot more expensive. It will put you in a fight with your spouse, which is problematic if you have kids. But in the end, almost every case settles, right? So at some point, you're not going to get your day in court, most of you, if you go to litigation. So you kind of dance the dance of litigation, but in the end, almost, you know, 9 out of 10 couples settle. And so you settle without getting all the answers, without figuring out all the things, without putting everything on the table. There's no guarantees on the other path, right?
Right.
So, you know, when people come to me and they say, well, I don't think my spouse is going to, you know, be forthright in their disclosures. Well, there's ways that I can help them, you know, evaluate whether that's happening or not. And we can do it in 3, 4, or 5 weeks. And if it's not happening at that point, you can always litigate. But in litigation, you're going to try to force them to disclose. And it might be a year and a half before you find out whether or not you're successful. And there are no guarantees. So, you know, there aren't guarantees in this world. And my advice to people generally is to try to get through it as quickly and with as least stress as possible. And sometimes that means, you know, biting your lip and taking deals that, you know, you can live with, but you quote unquote, you know, maybe they're not what you view as, you know, what you're owed or what's right or what's fair. It's more about what you can live with.
I want to piggyback on what you just said in terms of biting your lip and sometimes just sucking up certain things that you can live with, but maybe you're not 100% happy with. Maybe you're not getting as much child support as what you thought. Maybe you're paying a little bit more child support, whatever the case is. And I kind of want to compare that, like, in mediation versus litigation, because I think that sometimes the perception is that if they go the litigation route, that they would have gotten their way. And that's, from what I understand, not necessarily true. You're probably going to end up paying more to your attorneys and attorney's fees, things like that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you would have or that you are going to end up on the better side of that. But you're the expert here, so I'll let you kind of speak to that.
Yeah, I mean, you're not guaranteed. A lot of family law litigators get fired, you know, during the case, right? And there's a reason that people are generally unhappy with their family law attorneys when they're litigating, because they're not getting responses. It's hard to reach that person. That person has 30 versions of you that they're, you know, being dragged to emergency hearings on every morning, and they don't control their calendar. It's hard for them to be available. They're billing you for every second that you text them or call them or email them, and the bills, you know, wind up. But there are no guarantees in that process. If you litigate, you're not guaranteed to find out every single thing. You're not guaranteed to get what you want. There's a winner and a loser. But in the end, almost everyone will settle. So again, you're dancing the dance, but you don't hear the term trial attorney in family law very often.
Right.
You hear it as in personal injury, there's trial attorneys, and then there's personal injury lawyers. Or in business, that you'll hear business trial attorneys, and then there's more kind of business litigators. The people that have a reputation for going to court and trying cases doesn't really exist in family law as much in other segments of the law, because almost everyone is dancing the dance, but then, you know, pressuring their client to settle at the end.
Have you ever dealt with a situation, whether it be because the couple was this way or there was just one person that was just refusing to negotiate or meet in the middle? Have you ever had to refer someone where it's just like, you know what, mediation just is not going to work? You know, and if that has happened to you, like, what do you do in those scenarios?
Yeah, you know, I'm not 100. I don't bat 100 or 1,000 or whatever you would call it. So, you know, we settle a really high percentage of our cases, but the cases that don't settle, you don't have to be, meeting in the middle or that, but you have to be willing to listen to the other side and understand where they're coming from, and then try to negotiate settlements that achieve as many of your objectives as possible, but that also give the other side something that they can hang their hat on.
Yeah.
A take it or leave it approach. Very hard to settle that sort of case, but a good mediator, again, when I go back to that term about the snowflake, Matthew, sometimes someone needs to hear, the truth about, you know, what's going to happen if we're not successful and the downside they face.
Mm-hmm.
Some people react defensively to that, hard truth talk. And so I need to be softer. My role is to understand how to reach people to get them to say yes in a way that they can both live with. And so I'm evaluating that, and I'm delivering messages and delivering information in a way to each party that I think will resonate the most. Yeah. So just a blanket, you know, I'm going to go through mediation. That's great. And I encourage that. But how you set that mediation up is really important. So who you hire as a mediator, crucial, crucially important. We're all not created equally. And you have to feel comfortable. So you're looking for a certain set of credentials, experience, expertise. You're also looking for a personality fit. And then, the mediator needs people to evaluate options and make decisions at some point. And so if you have a hard time making decisions without, because you feel like maybe you don't know, or maybe you think you're getting taken or something like that, then you need to set up the mediation with where you have a consultant, where you're talking about what's happening in mediation so that you can evaluate these things and make proposals from an informed place, because that's what a mediator needs. They need you to be engaged. You can't just take all the information, collect it every meeting, and then go away, and then we start over, and we are kind of starting at the same place. So you have to set up your process in a way that's going to put you in this as a likeliest position to be able to be successful as possible.
What would you say are some of the more common issues that prevent people from settling or being able to mediate? Do you think it's like resentment because, you know, someone just recently got cheated on, or they're just upset by the divorce altogether, or you mentioned just not listening to the other side, so they just poor communication. What from your perspective, what would prevent people from being able to successfully mediate?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think back to some of the, you know, unsuccessful cases, which I hate to languish on, but a financial settlement is really, it's rare for a financial settlement to not be successful in mediation. So, you know, usually the cases involve unique personality issues between the parents and then kids, either adult children with disabilities that require, ongoing support into their adulthood, or, you know, minor children where there's really different ideas for parenting. In terms of parenting time, if when one person comes in and says, you know, I think we're going to do, 90%, 10%, and the other person comes in and they say, you know, we're going to do 50-50, I thought, you know, it's hard to bridge that gap. So when does that really hold true? When do people really resist coming to agreements? Typically, it's when one parent has been more of the primary, more traditional roles. And then the other parent has been, more of the income producer. And now, they're going to be splitting into two households. And each party is going to, if you go to court, each person's going to be given a chance to show and prove that they can be good parents, because that's what courts, at least in California, want. They want both parents to be actively involved, because the state of California believes that when kids have two parents that love them, that are safe, that are within the spectrum of normal, that kids are better off with them in their lives. So when that parent who has traditionally been the primary, pushes back and wants to continue being the primary, but the other parent, wants to have access to them in a greater degree, that's usually the kind of the situation where it's harder to bridge that gap. But a pure financial settlement, dividing assets, coming up with support, it's very pretty rare for my cases for us not to be successful.
On the flip side, what do you think it takes, or what would you say are the more common traits of mediations that do end successfully? And that, I don't want to say it's easy. I want to make it sound like, that it's just a cakewalk, but where you can kind of typically see some signs that you're this is something that I could see happening.
Yeah, it when you take ownership of the process. So you're thinking about it, you're game planning, you're coming up with solutions between the meetings, not necessarily with each other. If my clients, when they have healthy communication, I encourage it. If one person doesn't want to have communication about the settlement, with the other person between the meetings, then we don't do it. But just when you're taking ownership. So the worst way to approach, and I don't judge anyone that has to litigate. I used to be a litigator. I have lots of friends that are litigators. It's there. I just want to encourage people, try this alternative first, because the benefits can be so immense in terms of time savings and money and right. just health and parenting. But in terms of the litigation versus mediation alternative, people that hand over their case to a litigator and say, here, you deal with it, that's the worst way to set this up. You want to be in control to some extent. You want to be engaged. You don't want to just hand your life over to this stranger that has a good website or some rankings or reviews or that helped your friend down the street and just give them, you know, all the control and none of your input. In mediation, right. my clients that take ownership, that are like, when I ask them a question, I can tell they've thought about it. Or maybe they haven't thought about it at that meeting, but they come back the next time and they're talking about ways that they think that this could be handled. That just taking that active ownership and involvement is how you can set this up to be successful.
I imagine that, well, let me rephrase. I was going to say, I imagine that's difficult because oftentimes communication is such a is such a big part of reasons why people end up divorced, you know. So would you say that it's more common for people to be able to have healthy communication in those situations, or what would you say about that?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, more of my clients, we reserve the discussions for the mediation sessions themselves. But, you know, some of them do engage with each other. I hear often, you know, I see a lot of generosity in my practice. So, you know, my litigation friends, when we go out to lunch or coffee, they say, you know, they're surprised to hear that. And they say, oh, that must be a marriage that lasted 2 years and no kids and no assets. And definitely not the case. Yeah. But in terms of the approach, I see a lot of times people being more, because of the collaborative nature and the idea generation that we're doing as a team, and they're taking kind of an active ownership of those ideas and those solutions. I see people being a lot, very generous with each other in terms of listening and making proposals that go beyond, you know, necessarily what the law provides. Less clients than more have those kind of active discussions without me being present, but it certainly happens. Again, I don't want someone to feel pressured. I hear all the time in an initial meeting, we came to an agreement already. And then when we have our discussion, I always say, well, okay, you know, we'll talk about it, you know, when we start our mediation. And then when we start, I could tell one person is feeling, you know, uncomfortable with those discussions that happen. And I have to explain, look, people often have discussions before the mediations where they might have, you know, one person thinks they have an agreement, the other, you know, doesn't feel that way. But until you have an agreement, you don't. Those discussions were, you know, productive or not productive, but in terms of my work, we're going to start from scratch and then go from there. And that's kind of like delivering that message in a way that, you know, doesn't put off the person who thought that we had a deal going into this. Yeah. You know, again, it's not like I deliver all the news in the same hard way or harsh way or, you know, where's the reality? I need to evaluate people and say things in a way that reaches them to help be productive, not impact them negatively.
When it comes to mediation versus litigation long term after the fact, do you see more people who need modifications after litigation versus mediation, or is that kind of a trend that you see? Is that something that,
I mean, I have a definite answer. I'm interested to hear if you what do you think on that topic?
I think that definitely after litigation, there's probably a high probability of modifications afterwards, and with mediation it's probably less, because I imagine that after mediation, you know, if you're able to mediate the divorce, then more than likely you're able to come to terms on other things afterwards, more than likely. I'm not saying they don't ever need a modification, but I would imagine that it's more likely that they're able to, where after litigation, because everything is highly contested, a lot of times people are just doing it just to get back at the other person or whatever. And that litigation just continues afterwards and just, it just sets a pattern, sets them up, you know, moving forward.
I agree with you. I think that when, you know, people are not used to having judges or, you know, other attorneys, you know, force things upon them. So whether that's a judge making a ruling or your own attorney saying, look, this is it. If you want me to be on your case, we're going to settle this now, or you're going to have to get another attorney, or, you know, you running out of money. So you have to make those sorts of things, those sorts of agreements that you don't want to make. But when you have things imposed on you, the natural humanity in all of us is to resist that imposition. So you resist, you're supposed to, you know, return the kids by, you know, Sunday at 4 p.m. Sunday at 5:45 is when it happens every week. Or, you know, people drag their feet. People intentionally create, you know, get back at the other person in small ways where they think they can get away with it without being dragged back to court. And then if they are dragged back to court, they're just going to get a slap on the wrist and told not to do it again most of the time. Mediation, because you're creating those agreements, you you have more skin in the game, so that you're more I think it's a lot less likely, tremendously less likely, to end up in a litigated, contested modification scenario you know, than if you would litigate. I think that's 1,000,000% true. My you know, clients do call me for modifications. They typically are about child support or spousal support changes based on income. Sometimes it's about parenting, but it's collaborative. Again, they're willing to approach the process, you know, to make, you know, voluntary decisions that keep them out of court. And so it's more oftentimes on a financial, you know, decision or change, which, you know, they're willing to negotiate or figure out.
Come from your perspective, being on both sides of it, with litigation and with mediation, what's your stance on prenups, and do they help on both sides of it? Do they help with the mediation side of it as well, or what's your stance on?
Yeah, I mean, so I don't litigate cases. I stopped litigating in 2012. I think it's really important that, you know, attorneys pick a lane and stick to it. I know that that's not a popular sentiment. Most litigators also mediate. I think that, you know, I think that, like I said, not all mediations are made equal. And I think you're setting yourself up for a problem right away if you're hiring a litigator to mediate. It's a different approach. It's a different timeline. They're not used to, you know, one of the big advantages of mediation is to get it started and get it wrapped up. And litigators are used to a 2.5 year cycle. So, you know, their version might be 6 or 8 months, and that's so fast to them. Whereas a mediator, you know, typically I'm working for people actively for 2 months, you know, 1-2 months where we're actively engaged and then all the work is done. But so that, putting that aside, I think prenups can have very big impacts on people's lives. I think you have to be very careful. I have mediated a lot of cases where the case is more about negotiating a settlement that goes beyond the prenup, but that honors, you know, the core of the prenup. But, you know, if you're 30 and getting married to someone that's a high net worth earner, or that if you're 50 and you're getting married, and basically if you have a lifestyle that is created by the other person's, you know, income or assets, and then that marriage is ending, you are, you know, if the prenup is, you know, a heart, you know, written so that, you know, you each keep all your own stuff or whatever, something like that, the prenup can protect that high net worth or high asset person, but it will have a serious impact on the other person's lifestyle. I had a case recently where they were in their mid-50s. They'd been married about 10 years, second marriage for each of them. One person, you know, quit their job and kind of traveled the world. They traveled the world together in this case, the husband's kind of asset and income capabilities.
And it was a really black and white prenup. We negotiated a settlement that gave, wife in this case more than what the prenup called for, but her lifestyle changed overnight hugely. So you just have to be careful when you're, negotiating a prenup. You have to make sure that you're planning for the future. If you're the downside person in terms of assets and income, you need to negotiate it, with an eye on the exit of the marriage and what would happen if you're in it for 20 years or if you're in a long-term situation. Now you're 50, not 30. Your income, capabilities are dramatically impacted by not being in the workforce actively, things like that. So, they protect assets and they offer great protection for one party. And that's great if both are on board. But I see the other side of it often where, the big impact and change of lifestyle is going to happen as a result of the prenup. And, if that person would have maybe negotiated, more intently in the prenup discussion portion, they could have maybe gotten an outcome that would be different.
Yeah. Scott, I could talk to you about this all day, every day. You are a wealth of knowledge and we appreciate your time. Let people know where they can find you at if they want to work with you, or if they just want to know more information, or if they want to refer friends or family members to you, things of that nature. Where are some places that they can find you at or find more information?
Yeah, of course. Well, thank you for having me, Matthew. Sorry that my answers were so long. I feel like I talked.
It always feels like you're like that when you're the guest, but they were perfect, Matt. I mean, that's kind of the point of a podcast. You can go into a lot more depth, a lot more detail. We appreciate it. You weren't long-winded at all. And so we appreciate you going into so much detail.
Cool, man. Well, I work all over California as a consulting attorney for people that are working in other mediations, as someone that can represent people in prenuptial and postnuptial agreements, and as a mediation attorney for people going through divorce or want a post-divorce conflict resolution. So those are the services I offer. I go by the name Chief Peacekeeper, Scott Levin. You can reach me, sandiegofamilylawyer.net is the website. But if you search Scott Levin or Chief Peacekeeper, you'll find my social platforms and you can reach out.
You can also find all of his information down below in the show notes or in the details of this, depending on where you are listening. If you're listening on any of the podcast platforms, or if you're watching this on YouTube, make sure you go down to the comment section down below. Let Scott know, let us know some things that, some takeaways, some things that you may have learned that maybe you didn't know before. Also go to all of his social media platforms, show him some love, tell him thank you for showing up. Make sure you give him a follow, especially if you guys are out in California. Refer him to people that might need his services. With all that being said, thank you so much, and I will see you on the next episode. Yes, sir.